So I'd like to start with a little bit of a review. This is the high school teacher in me that needs to remind her students where they've been and where they're going. And so I do want to just review a little bit for all of you, but especially for those of you that are new to us, that we have been working through this whole year, the major teachings of the Buddha. And some of you will remember that we spent several weeks studying and talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. And this month, the team here at Orlando Insight have turned our attention to the teaching of the Buddha called the Four Divine Abodes. Now, Peter and Susan have beautifully talked about these concepts. Just to review, though, in Buddhism, the divine abodes, or called the Brahma Viharas, are the four wholesome qualities of mind and of meditation practices that we cultivate an awakened, balanced heart. Often referred to as the four immeasurables, these concepts serve as the ultimate emotional dwelling place for practitioners to relate to themselves and to others. Please note, this is so important for me personally, but for all of us, please note that the abodes are certainly laudable states of mind meant to be observed and appreciated and embraced. But they are also practices to be taken up mindfully as a way of opening our hearts. Peter spoke in the first 2 weeks of the month about the first two abodes. First is loving kindness, or the Pali word is metta. Then the second week, he talked about compassion, which is karuna. He beautifully reviewed the guided meditation practice for metta. And then on the third week, Susan spoke, this was just last week, Susan spoke last week on the third abode, which is called empathetic joy or mudita. In her comments on practice, she gave us, Susan always manages to get one really powerful line for me that really sticks with me. In this particular talk that she did last week, she gave this powerful guide for nurturing unconditional goodwill. And it is, I rejoice in your happiness. May your happiness continue. I wrote those two sentences every day in my journal this week, and I think it really worked. And both Peter and Susan led us through actual practices that we can do to cultivate these qualities. So now, standing firmly on their shoulders tonight, I have some thoughts to share with you on the last divine abode, which is equanimity or upekkha. At a much earlier time in my life, equanimity was one of the last things I might have wanted. It was a word that, in my ignorance, conjured passivity, inaction, indifference, non-engagement, lack of passion. I wanted none of that. And I wanted action, full-out engagement, passion, and commitment to life. I've been told a few times by people who grew up with me that I was a lively and fun-loving young person with youthful energies and youthful ambitions for helping the world. I graduated from high school smack dab in the middle of the 60s and was deeply affected by the turmoil of that decade. But my profoundly youthful strategies for living a happy and productive life eventually, some decades later, became exhausting, demanding, stressful, often intolerant of those who disagreed with my mission in life. Today, many decades later, one of the primary traits I seek in my life is equanimity. How interesting those things turn. Because now I have a much richer understanding of the word as it is used in the Buddhist studies. My understanding of this practice over the years has come from several key teachers that I rely on, and you can see the resources that I have relied on for this talk in the chat. So let's start with some basic definitions, and then I'll try to elaborate a little bit on them. My trusty American Heritage Dictionary, beautifully leather-bound and given to me by my mother on my 21st birthday, that dictionary, you think I'm an old fuddy-duddy, don't you, using a dictionary, but I do. That dictionary tells me that the word equanimity comes from the Latin equus, meaning equal or level, and the word animus, Latin animus, meaning mind or soul. Synonyms shown in the dictionary were composure, poise, serenity, imperturbability, love that word, imperturbable. That's Peter Carlson. And finally, and most importantly, non-reactivity. Some of you may be familiar with the Stanford Lifestyle Medicine Program, which puts out very interesting articles and studies. And they say that equanimity is a state of psychological stability, mental calmness, and emotional composure that remains undisturbed by stress, shock, or difficult situations. It is the ability to maintain an even mind, neither becoming overwhelmed by negative emotions or losing focus amidst chaos. And that last part of that definition might pretty well describe my 20s, overwhelmed by negative emotions and losing focus amidst chaos. There was a lot of chaos in the 60s. Our old friend and teacher, Joseph Goldstein, says that the equanimous mind is imperturbable and balanced with an impartiality that embraces all. Okay, so far so good, huh? You got all of that down and we're all clear on what equanimity is. Maybe we're a little bit clearer, but let's go a little bit deeper, okay? Especially into the text that I've referred to in the chat. Pema Chodron, who's deeply on my mind these days, I'm immersing myself in her work, rereading books of hers that I've already read and reading her newest one again. She speaks, I think, most eloquently about the importance of practicing equanimity as opposed to simply observing it as a positive state. And she goes so far as to say that without this fourth boundless quality of equanimity, the other three divine abodes are limited by our habit of liking and disliking, accepting and rejecting. In her inimitable, heartfelt manner, she says, "Training in equanimity is learning to open the door to all, welcoming all beings, inviting life to come in and visit." That is such a lovely way to describe this quality that we're focusing on tonight. And it makes me think of Rumi. Some of you may know the poet Rumi. He was a Sufi mystic poet writing some 1600 years after the Buddha. He wrote a poem called The House Guest, and I'd like to read that to you. "This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for something new, for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Who, 1600 years later, seems like he and the Buddha had a lot in common, right? Equanimity is having a spacious mind that can include everything, as Rumi advises, while not being reactive to anything. When there is reactivity, it comes in two ways usually, aversion to something or attachment to something. An equanimous mind holds a balance in inner and outer response. Without reactivity, without aversion, without attachment, it is a mind marked by impartiality and imperturbability. It is a mind open and receptive. It receives everything equally without preferences. Equanimity is a guest house. I also like the description Martin Aylward gives of equanimity in his book, Awake Where You Are, The Art of Embodied Awareness, one of my all-time famous, favorite books on the teachings. In that book, he says, equanimity is an open and free heart in which nothing gets stuck. Whatever arises can be deeply felt without obsession, without rejection. The usual circus of contraction, fixation, rejection, judgment, and ego drama looks unnecessary and exhausting, foolish and futile, pathological even. End quote. I certainly have spent my fair share of time at that circus of pathologies. But there is an antidote to the circus of pathologies. In the spacious mind and the open heart of equanimity, aversion and attachment can come and go within the field of awareness. With mindfulness, we can see when the mind is resisting or when it is attached and clinging. If there is reactivity, mindfulness can see it, and it is addressed wisely. This spacious mind leaves room for wise response to any situation, or for compassion to arise. It does not argue with reality. In this way, equanimity is closely linked to the cultivation of the wisdom factor, the wisdom of clear seeing, the wisdom of letting go. The Buddha called the equanimous mind, mind like sky. I don't know when I first read his use of that phrase, but I think I've used it in almost every single guided meditation that I've led. Mind like sky. When we are mindful, we have clarity, the capacity to see, the capacity to understand what is going on in the mind. This means all things are allowed. We can see things as they are and not react with an unwholesome state of mind. A good response to a situation means we can discern what is best to do in the moment. So equanimity is not passive at all, as my 20-year-old self thought. It allows for action when action is wise and thoughtful. When we cultivate equanimity, and it must be cultivated, we want to know our minds and to recognize when unwholesome states arise, then respond to those states with kindness, with compassion, with curiosity. We notice what qualities are causing goodwill, both to ourselves and to others, and what qualities are eliciting beneficial action in the world. This is the kind of investigation the Buddha called right effort, and right effort leads to equanimity. An equanimous person is not a doormat. I didn't understand this in my 20s. There is a big difference between indifference and equanimity. The equanimous person cares deeply. She has space to know what would be most helpful in a given moment without causing harm. It's important to repeat that equanimity allows us to take wise action in the face of our own reactivity. Let me tell you what the Buddha says about equanimity. A bhikkhu understands there is equanimity, awakening factor within him, or there is no equanimity awakening factor within him. A bhikkhu also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen equanimity factor, and how the arisen equanimity enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. Comes to fulfillment by development. I really got stuck for a moment on that phrase. Comes to fulfillment by development. What might fulfillment by development of equanimity as a quality of mind look like, I ask myself. Well, several people have told us what it looks like, and I'm going to share it with you. When it comes to training the mind, definitions are definitely helpful, and I hope I've given you lots of definitions here, but they are not sufficient. Definitions are helpful, but not sufficient. Ultimately, what we want to know, what do we actually do to cultivate equanimity? What is the practice? Well, I'm going to tell you what members of my resource group have told me. I am just a channel of summary, really, here, folks. I'm not presenting you with any original thoughts, maybe just original combination of them. But Sayadaw U. Pandita says, as do many, many teachers, that the first directive is mindfulness practice. When mindfulness and concentration continue to deepen, he says, in your practice, equanimity becomes predominant. The mind becomes balanced. So be mindful. Over and over and over again. Practice mindfulness. In her wonderful book, I had a copy of it someplace around here, Comfortable with Uncertainty, Pema Chodron explains that the equanimous person is fully attuned to the prevailing state of uncertainty. By the way, I just so recommend all of these books, and this book, Comfortable with Uncertainty, is just wonderful, and it's 108 short chapters, so it's one of those great early morning reading books. So she says in that book that the equanimous person is fully attuned to the prevailing state of uncertainty. In other words, instead of shunning uncertainty and trying to get away from it, she says, tune in. The equanimous mind is willing to cut through it, through the personal reactivity and the self-deception. The tools, she says, are before us. Sitting meditation, practicing Tonglen, slogan practice, and cultivating the divine abodes, which we've been doing all month long. I love her rendition of the loving kindness mantra, where she says, may I dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. She also says, we all desperately need more insight into what leads to happiness and what leads to pain. And this has become such an important I don't know what to call it, such an important lesson or caveat for me. Take note, Leslie, what's causing happiness? What causes happiness to arise? What's causing suffering? So many times we flail around in life because we've been unable to distinguish between the two, which seems kind of silly. If you do pick up the book, though, Comfortable with Uncertainty, please look especially at lessons 39 and 40. And those are the sections on equanimity that I found so uniquely helpful to my own investigation. Finally, I want to introduce you to a teacher you may or may not know about. Her name is Kamala Masters, and she's a guiding teacher at the Insight Meditation Society. And she's the one that did that fabulous podcast with on 10% Happier with, you guys know who did it.
Dan Harris.
Dan Harris, thank you. it's hard not to say Sam Harris. They are not related, but I listen to both of them a lot. So Dan Harris interviewed Kamala Harris. This was several years ago, and that's a wonderful podcast interview, and she just does such a gracious and detailed explanation of her own personal experience with coming to understand this fourth divine abode. And then she gives four arenas of practice. And I'm not going to have time tonight to go into all of them, but I do want to share with you the core statements or the core phrases or the core questions that she asked us in our practice to employ in our practice. So she says, firstly, start with yourself. This is again hearkening back to where we began with Peter when he introduced us to loving kindness meditation and the four levels of address that we make in a loving kindness meditation. So just like in loving kindness meditation, in equanimity meditation, you start with yourself. And she says, when you feel reactivity in your body, offer equanimity to yourself. And here are the sentences that she says to offer. May I open to things as they are. May I open to this situation with balance. May I know what to say or when to be quiet. Statements like these make your mind more open and balanced. So sometimes it's just something as little as offering that mantra before you begin your meditation, or maybe even using that as a statement within your meditation practice. The second directive that she gives is to develop equanimity toward challenging life circumstances. And here are some of the phrases she encourages us to say over and over as we're trying to cultivate equanimity. This is surrounding challenging circumstances. Pleasure and pain arise and pass away. What would life be like if we just remembered that? Pleasure and pain arise and they pass away. This is how it is in life. Another one, birth and death are part of life. And another, gain and loss are inevitable. These are wisdom statements because they are grounded in reality. It is what it is. And in this practice, she is just advocating that we accept what is. The third set of statements then are directed toward people you know who may be suffering. And I've really used this in the last few months because I seem to be in the space of several people who are having some difficult problems and suffering in some normally human ways. And here are some things that she offers that we might say to a friend or family member who is suffering. May you have balance in your life. You know those times when you want to advise somebody or you want to help them, you want to try to help them understand what's going wrong? Unlikely that you're going to do those things, but to offer somebody balance in life might cut through some of the confusion. Another one she says to say is, this is how it is in your life right now. It won't always be that way. This is how it is in your life right now. This is how your life is unfolding. Or you're trying to align how it really is in life in ever-deepening ways. What a gentle and encouraging way to equanimously offer advice to a suffering person. You're trying to align to how it really is in life in ever-deepening ways. And finally, she gives us phrases to say toward all people known and unknown. She says, and oh, this is the one that I really, really love. All beings are owners of their karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions and not upon my wishes. I'm going to read that one again. All beings are owners of their own karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions and not upon my wishes. All beings have their own journey. I remember that we are all just human. And finally, I offer you my goodwill, and things are just as they are right now. Soak it up, my friends, soak it up. Masters goes on to say that equanimity is related to the wisdom factor, as I've said before, because it allows us to stop fighting with reality. And we know when you pick a fight with reality, you're bound to be the loser in that fight. As we stop fighting reality, we come to see things as they are and to respond in beneficial ways. Equanimity knows when to be quiet and when to take action. It is not passive. It is not indifferent. Equanimity is a sign of goodwill toward all beings. So I have given here examples of practices from three contemporary teachers that help us take responsibility for our own minds through right effort, that is knowing what is beneficial and acting on that, and knowing what is not beneficial and refraining from acting on that. We have little control over the circus that Martin Aylward referred to earlier. But the mind that views the circus can be changed. Knowing this brings forth equanimity and wisdom. As I conclude, I would like to say that after years of study and practice, I started my meditation practice in my 20s. Today, I hold a better understanding of this teaching than I did all those decades ago. I have learned that cultivating equanimity has little to do with my frantic ordering of my external world so that I can be calm and free of agitation and at ease. I now see equanimity as an internal state, not an external state. It's an internal state of non-reactivity, creating a balanced mind in the face of disorder, agitation, and confusion. I would like to end this talk with a short guided meditation, which is actually printed in the preface at the very front of the opening of Pema Chodron's book, Comfortable with Uncertainty. I would like to read this short devotion twice slowly as a way of our anchoring her beautiful words in our minds and in our hearts at this very challenging time of life that we're all experiencing. So if you care to, you can close your eyes or you can just sit calmly where you are. I'll just go two times through these four lines. May all sentient beings enjoy happiness in the root of happiness. May we be free from suffering in the root of suffering. May we not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. May we dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. May all sentient beings enjoy happiness in the root of happiness. May we be free from suffering in the root of suffering. May we not be separated from the great happiness devoid of suffering. And finally, may we all dwell in the great equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and prejudice. Thank you all very much. I hope this has been of benefit to you. It was certainly of great benefit to me to pull all of these ideas together, and I would love to chat with you about your own understandings or misunderstandings of equanimity. Can any of you identify an earlier time in your life when you might not have wanted or you might have misunderstood as I did? And I think a lot of people do misunderstand what people think equanimity is, just like sitting zenned out, totally unattached to anything. I hope I've disabused all of us of that notion. Do any of you have a time of life that you can recall where you might not have wanted those, but you because of the eagerness of living life full out and with passion and a very loud voice? That was kind of where I was in my 20s, a very loud voice. Yeah, Annette. Annette and Ron are new to our group tonight. They have come to the Monday night group, but this is their first time at the Wednesday night Sangha. We welcome you so
much. Thank you. Thank you.
So good to see you. So, Annette, you got something to say about equanimity in your life.
I have something to say about a lot of things, but I want to thank you for inviting us, Leslie. As you know, we were part of Fish Lake Sangha for 20-some years until recently when the leaders moved to Boulder, Colorado. So we've been looking for a new group to study and practice with. But you talking about your 20s clicked with me, because in my 20s and 30s, I thought living and working in Manhattan in New York City was the best life I could possibly have. Nonstop activity, night and day, busy working, going out, cultural things, bars, whatever. And I thought getting married, living in a house would be so boring that the only way to be happy was to be constantly busy and productive and doing things. And so it took me quite a few years to feel that equanimity and peace don't come from being busy and running around the city and nonstop working and playing, that you can find peace in what may look like a boring or normal life, but it really does come from the inside. And for many decades, I only got it from the outside.
That's so, thank you. That just, you made me not feel like an odd character. So thank you. Thank you.
Did you want to say something?
Sure.
Yeah, Ron would like to say something.
Yeah. Well, first, I agree with Annette. And my 20s were probably similar in some ways to yours. And I not only graduated college in the late 60s, early 70s, but I deliberately moved to Washington, D.C., so to a very strong political science program. And, of course, the war in Vietnam was going on. And I would say that if I'd heard these words those decades ago, to me, it would have sounded like bourgeois or, being a hopeless romantic in the face of, a great tragedy and inhumanity. And I would have pushed myself away thinking that I had just given up and I'd lost my mind, because there wasn't a lot of room for compassion at that point. There was room instead for political victory or not on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just conclude by remembering an apt phrase reportedly written and said by Jesus, and that was to be in the world, but not of the world. And so it is. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ron. We're sure. So glad to have you both here. And we hope you will consider us as a viable option for stepping in for Fish Lake Sangha, which cannot be replaced. I know Bob Allen very well, so I'm sorry for your loss of that group. So good. Yes, Susan, comment.
Two things. One, you had mentioned stuff in the chat. There's nothing in the chat related to books and stuff. Maybe you put it in there before I got in. And so folks who came in later can't see it. So just FYI.
That really helped.
There you go. Right there.
The little arrow. So sorry.
The little arrow is helpful. So thanks for putting that.
Very helpful.
Love the quotes by Pema Chodron and the meditation at the end. Thank you for doing that twice, because the first time I got to really listen to it and the second time I got to do it. So I greatly appreciate that. My 20s were probably different in that I was married when I was a senior in college, like halfway through my senior year. And then within a year had my first child. And then a couple years later had my next one. So I was just constant going and doing. And my husband at the time was active duty military, and Desert Storm was happening. So, and he was in 82nd Airborne. So doing all that stuff, I couldn't slow down to contemplate anything. And when I started meditating, I misunderstood a lot about equanimity and did not think of it as something active. Was one of those who thought, oh, it's zenned out. Let's sit back. Let's just think happy thoughts. It reminded me of cloistered nuns who don't speak to anyone but pray all the time for folks. And that's sort of how I initially understood it. And I'm very grateful that my curiosity and teachers explained it better, but yours actually was probably the most clear and directive manner of explaining equanimity and how it's not passive that I've heard. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think for me, especially through Pema Chodron, I even in just these last months of doing a lot of reading of her and knowing that I was coming up on this talk, I think I did not think of the, well, I thought of the first abode, loving kindness, as a practice, but I guess I never really thought about the other three as a practice. And she makes that point so beautifully that it is Well, all of the people that I refer to do that. It is something we can cultivate. It's a quality which is a seed within us. We come hardwired with the seed of equanimity, but that seed has to be watered and cultivated. And so I've enjoyed trying to add that that to my practice. So thank you, Susan. Anybody else? Thoughts or annoyances with adding yet another layer to things you have to say or do during your practice? I know there can be a time where you reach a kind of overload with what's supposed to be happening while you meditate, but
Leslie?
Yeah, Peter?
Can I share with you all what my experience was during the meditation, the practice prior to this meeting?
Sure.
For those of you who might be listening who weren't participating, we were bombed. Some young people kept, a variety of young people were intruding, trying to be disruptive. But, you know, I spent a lot of time meditating, and this was maybe two-thirds of the way through the meditation period when this started happening. So I had this quietness in the mind, very stable, very peaceful, and really clearly investigating what was like to be in my body. With the breath and body scanning and so forth. And then this started to happen. And as it was happening, I just simply started to do what in 12-stepping is called the next right thing, which would be to try to block it. And as that was happening, part of my mind was saying, wow, this would be a good time to talk to these young people about suffering, right? And realize that that's what they want. They want some kind of reaction, right? And this was a group of young people. There were several different faces that showed up, and they looked like they were in some kind of a room, maybe in an apartment building somewhere.
Was it just one person? I mean, was it one Zoom caller with several people in on the Zoom, or were there?
There were several people. But anyway, that my experience of equanimity came from the preliminary quietness, what Pema Chodron would call relative bodhicitta, relative awakening mind. And that created a space of non-reactivity, and I was able to make decisions. I could have gotten hooked, which is the far enemy of equanimity,
mm-hmm.
Or I could have just shut down, you know. But I was aware, and I was taking action in a way that would be effective. And then afterwards, I got to learn about how to prevent that, interrupt that in the future. But anyway, that I wanted to talk about my experience of realizing the benefit of equanimity. It was already there, so to speak. The potential to be non-reactive was already in place because of my dedicated practice. And then it was just this is what happened. Right. Just like you were saying, some of those quotes, this is what's happening. What are you going to do about it? And keep your clarity and keep your tranquility and non-reactivity. So that I just wanted to share that for those of you who were experiencing this meditation period before the meeting.
Yeah, you look very equanimous.
Yeah.
What?
A perfect example for us as as a founding teacher should be. Thank you. You know, I'm wondering too, though, if, oh, did some, Robin, did you have something?
Yeah, I think someone on the phone wanted to talk too.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Hey, hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Thanks so much for talking about equanimity, which of course is one of my awarenesses for the stabilizing of emotion. And I also wanted to say welcome to Ron and Annette, because I'm glad you were able to join this group. But the thing that today, it's circumstantial. What my point would be that this is circumstantial. I have, and especially a health issue that is emerging, and it was playing on my concerns of fear, maybe, you know, the emotion of what is this and how do I deal with it? And you don't get out of life without having issues pop up that impact your wellness, and this is about wellness. I was trying to see a specialist, which I got to do, and it turns out to be more serious than I wanted it to be, and so I have to balance my emotions, and that's where the equanimity comes in, to not allow things to the mind to go into a place of fear. What if this, what if that? So I'm just taking, and I got to practice this today, particularly today, because I did see one specialist and I'm going to see another one. That's what my path is going to involve. So I just wanted to say your talk is very timely.
Oh,
and even
yeah.
Yeah, even though you're relating it to a time in the past, and I too was a child of the 60s, and I do remember all of the instability then, but I would say that in older age, there's more opportunity to lose my balance or lose the equanimity due to recognizing that this is a, you know, this is a time of life where things are personally can be personally troublesome. So I don't want to talk too much, but thank you.
That's great. That's so such a good example on the health issue. And I would remind you and all of us to remember that these four teachings go together. So as you're struggling with this, trying to deal with the reactivity of an illness or discovery of an illness, also remember loving kindness first and foremost to yourself. And so I like the thinking about them as an interrelated group of teachings. I think Robin had a comment.
Yes. Hi, Leslie. So you said at one stage, may I dwell in the great, was it the great equanimity free of passion, aggression, and the last one?
Let's see what she says. Prejudice.
Prejudice. That was it. Okay, perfect. Thank you. It was interesting because when the young men, for want of a better word, came into the meeting and I heard them, I opened my eyes and I looked at Peter, and Peter was totally calm and still. And so I thought, huh, okay, so maybe these people are in here. It's a plant to test us. To keep.
Leslie planned it, yes. I had them come and disturb the meeting to see how everybody would react. That's good.
Great to put up for a discussion of equanimity, right?
And the Buddha was sitting under the tree, right? And, the, oh, and I thought, well, that's kind of a silly idea. But for a moment, I had that. Because
no, actually, I think it's a great idea.
It's a great idea. Because Peter just stayed calm. And I thought, well, Peter's not reacting. Why? You know, I'm not going to say anything. And so I just continued meditating through it. And I just thought that was so, so cool. And I think probably if we just sat here and meditated and didn't react, they probably would have just went away. And I think that's about equanimity too, right? Like some people are looking for a reaction And when we don't give that, then they move on. And because it's a quote unquote healthier way of living or being, you know, than the way I used to be in my 20s, reacting to everything. So, you know, I just thought that was just such a great example.
Yeah, it
You know,
really was. And I think it's important for us to remember that all of these teachers emphasize the wisdom aspect of this, which is the necessity of being discerning when you're cultivating or when you're employing equanimity. And it doesn't mean you don't take action. I mean, look what Peter did. He took action. But it was wise action and thoughtful action that quietly removed people from the room and let me do my talk. So things went on. And so I think that's one of the things that from my own past experience, I most regret that I thought of it as an impotent kind of person who didn't really know to handle how to handle a difficult or challenging or strong situations. And that is not the case at all. I only once in my life had the honor of listening to Thich Nhat Hanh give a talk to a large room in a large auditorium, and I can't remember what war. This was decades ago. I can't remember what war was going on, but there was a woman in the back that rose up. He was talking about acceptance and equanimity, and he said, this woman said, "How can you ask us to accept this war? This is an evil war, blah blah blah." And he just stood there very calmly, very equanimous, as she went on railing for quite a long time. And finally, when she stopped, he said, "Being in this state of equanimity does not mean that you condone the situation that you're feeling a reactivity. You're feeling a reactive moment here." He didn't use that word, but that's essentially what he meant. It doesn't mean, I've always remembered that line where it says, it doesn't mean we condone it. It just means it's here. And again, notice how many times in this talk I said that all of these teachers kept going back to, it is real. This is real. This is life is happening right now. And you have an illness, okay? How are you going to react to this? And I just think that's so important that non-reaction does not mean condoning the behavior that you're observing. And Peter in no way condoned the behavior of those young people. He just eradicated them from his life, which is wise action, if you ask me. So thank you, Robin. That's good points.
Well, I'll say what I've said before. More practice is
More
necessary.
practice is necessary. So true.
I have an unrelated question for Leslie.
Yes, can you hear that question from Satish, Leslie?
Okay, what is it?
Do you record your Monday sessions?
You know what? We have not been, but we have said we are going to. Susan, help me out. We just haven't. We want to. Yeah, we
Yeah.
want to get those April says she wants to get them up on the website.
Yeah, we're looking at recording those, putting them on the website, and also reinvigorating the Orlando Insight Meditation Group YouTube channel and moving the archive of all of Peter's talks and Leslie's talks and April's talks and mine. Mine are just a few because I'm the newest teacher. Moving all those to YouTube, and the Monday night stuff will be there as well. So I will guess to say that starting probably August, we'll be much better at recording our Monday night stuff and getting it up. Right now, we're still getting Monday night set, and having it's an hour long, and having it appropriate for those who attend. We'll only have the talks online. And potentially the guided meditations, but not the Q&A at the end.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Great question.
Well, Peter, if everybody feels totally equanimous, I think we can close it out for the evening. Thank you all so much. I look forward to visiting with you again soon.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie. Yeah, thank you. Great presentation.
As is our custom, let's sit together briefly. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. Hope we'll all be reasonably safe and happy till the next time.